Cool. All right, everybody, thank you for joining my talk. It's a reference to Ghostbusters. Hopefully, if you're old enough and young enough, you know what that is. And we'll kind of see like why I thought that was an appropriate reference and in a little bit. Just a little bit about myself. I'm an embedded software consultant. My main focus is design work. I do design for all sorts of products, medical devices. This talk has been an inspiration because I've done a fair bit of embedded software work for a custom ASIC. The client has been doing a lot of RISC-V work for that ASIC. They want to throw Zephyr on it, and a lot of the motivation for this talk and other talks has been through that work that I've done. You can check me out on LinkedIn and X, formerly known as Twitter. My expertise was originally in embedded Linux, migrated to Zephyr, and then started doing some Qt along the way for some reason. You can sign up for my newsletter for training workshops that I also do in person and on site. We actually have a workshop that's going on this month, actually, for Zephyr. So if you're interested, it's all virtual. You can sign up. We still have two sessions remaining. So it's a quick agenda of what we're going to talk about, just the background and motivation. I like to know what I'm doing before I start doing it and why that's important. I want to talk through some of the process that was involved in the project, and basically the project that I'm giving a talk about, some of the issues that were encountered, how I resolved them, some enhancements and next steps, and then any questions you may have. So just some background. I've been doing embedded software for about 15 years now, and the focus so far has been on software, right? And you make some assumptions when you do really any sort of software. You assume that the CPU does what you expect it to do, the compiler is mature and well-defined, that the hardware is mature and well-defined. That's sometimes not the case. You have vendors that release errata that say like, oh, you go to them, you ask questions, and you say something's not working. They say, well, you didn't read like the 10-point font on page 257 on paragraph 3 in that errata. So most of the time, hardware is mature. But then after a while, like I don't know, for me, after 10 years, software kind of really friendly for hobbyists or individuals, right? We can't, as an individual, afford to pay a royalty or upfront like substantial amount of cost. And so this is more appropriate instead for larger companies, for vendors that make actual products, actual commercial devices, and they ultimately pass that cost to the consumer. So this is where RISC-V comes in, right? And I've been kind of following RISC-V for the past couple of years. There's a lot of buzz around an open source ISA. And to me, like that just seemed like a buzzword, like it didn't really mean anything. But you know, it was cool, it was free. There's no license necessary to use the ISA. There's no royalty or significant upfront cost. It was essentially free. And just taking it back away from the individual side, but to the commercial side, there is an advantage now for companies to use the RISC-V ISA. It's not just, oh, it's open source, it's free, you know, that's it. No, it's actually, we're seeing actually massive reduction in costs for actual chips and microcontrollers that are coming out. On the right here, you can see a recent post from Hackaday where somebody built a really low-cost RISC-V supercomputer. And there's another advantage that I hope companies actually take if they use RISC-V that we'll get into a little bit. But what about for us? What about for hobbyists, right? Is there an advantage for using RISC-V? And the answer is yes. We can implement our own RISC-V proprietary compliant CPU. And it's probably easier to do it than a proprietary ISA, again, because we don't have to be worried about these legalities and financial issues that we may have to run into. So the question is, okay, that's great. Again, for me, like open source has been in the concept of like in the context of RISC-V has been a really abstract concept. It's like, okay, it's great, it's open source. Well, like what does that mean in terms of engineering? Like what can I do with it? And so one day, I imagine what everybody does before they go to sleep is like open up Hacker News. And one day I saw, hey, look, there's this Neo RV32, which is a customizable RISC-V SoC. So I opened up their webpage. I saw it on Adafruit. Their webpage looked pretty promising. And then I checked out their GitHub. And it was like, awesome, right? You know, this is actually from last week. There are commits that are happening. It seems pretty mature. And you know, like this is not a crypto coin. This is originally like a meme. Like if you're old enough, you know what that is. So you know, this got me really excited, right? And then when I was reading through the documentation, I noticed, you know, they had support for Zephyr. I checked out the Zephyr code base. I saw that there was a board for the Neo RV32. I saw that there was an SoC support for Neo RV32. So that got me really interested. So we have RISC-V, a repository that is reasonably up to date. People, there's commits that are happening to it. There's Zephyr supposed support to it. So let me get started and see where I can take this. So the first thing that I wanted to do is get the appropriate hardware. The documentation said that it can be flashed to an FPGA. They have a list of FPGAs that are supposed to work. So I decided to go with the UPduino V3. You can buy it off of Tiny AI's website. It's a Lattice FPGA. It's pretty inexpensive and small, and it was available at the time. So I have personally used like Xilinx and Altero, like really beefy FPGA boards, and from past work, but I didn't go with those. And the reason is because I didn't want to have to worry about starting to port things over to these other boards, and it's just like, let me just get something going with the target FPGA that they claim works with Zephyr, and let me start with that. And then worry about later, okay, what do I do? What do I need to do to start porting over the necessary IP to these other FPGA types? So I have the FPGA, I bought it. What's next? Well, in any FPGA development, you have the tool chain. So I decided to go, so they have support for both open source and commercial tool chains. I initially decided to go with the commercial tool chains just because they seem to work better. They have their IP blocks are natively implemented, so they're supposed to be as optimal as possible because it's their tool chain targeting their FPGA, so the primitives that are there should be as optimal as possible. So that was kind of the first step, and then the next step would be to migrate to using the open source tools that NeoR V32 supports. So I had to jump through some hoops to get everything all aligned. And usually, like FPGA tools require some handholding. It's not like, you know, unfortunately not like software work where you just check something out, you run a documented set of commands to, okay, get things going. It may not be a few set of commands, it could be lengthy, but you have something. With FPGAs, there's not necessarily a documented set of steps. You may have to go through some handholding, which I had to do, and I still ran into errors. So this is why I thought, like, you know, my expertise is not in FPGAs, it's more in software. So this is like, okay, now I'm going into the unknown. I'm looking for ghosts. I'm running into like issues that I don't know where to go. I'm going to try out on my own and see what happens. So first, right off the bat, I ran into errors just immediately. And when I reached out to the maintainer, they said, oh, like I haven't done this on the latest version of the toolchain in quite some time. And immediately within a few days, I tried to resolve it on my own. I could get so far. But then once I reached out, they were pretty responsive, and you know that shed some more light into the quality of this project. And so got it fixed in a few days. I was able to build the project, but I still ran into an issue. So the RISC-V implementation that's there, the NeoR V32, has a bootloader in the RTL, in the FPGA, that can be enabled. And what that allows you to do is flash an application image via the bootloader onto the FPGA, but when the bootloader boots, the LED should blink for 10 seconds, and you should see some UART output. So what you have to do is you just have to enable this bootloader enable flag in the RTL, build it, and you should have a bootloader. But that wasn't the case. And what ended up happening was, again, this is essentially a tool chain issue. So you know, this kind of just talks about like, you know, some issues that we usually run through with tool chains. And then, again, the same thing sort of happened here. The reason it wasn't actually building was I didn't properly configure some of the IP blocks that were in the actual tool chain that was being used. But once I did that, I was able to essentially get the build going and essentially just have, you know, this is just what's called a constraints file that tells you what the pinout in an FPGA is. And then once I was able to get it to build, I saw the bootloader essentially output on the console. So, you know, just going through the process of resolving FPGA issues to get a bootloader output on the FPGA. So now the question is, okay, we saw that we had support for RISC-V and Zephyr, specifically NeoR V32. What can we do to actually do something, right? So the first thing we want to do is try to flash the Hello World binary. So if you just run the standard West command to build Hello World for the NeoR V32 board, it's not sufficient on its own. You have to add this option to generate a bin file, and then if you don't, you get this warning that's generated. It still produces the L file, but the bootloader actually expects a bin file that you need to have. So to resolve it, what you want to do is they have the source code for the image gen tool under the software directory. All you have to do is just build it. They have a make file, and you can just add it to the path. So once I did that, I got the exe.bin file. And then the other thing that I noticed that was interesting was the zephyr.vhd file. And the reason that piqued my interest is because VHD is usually like an RTL file. So I was kind of surprised as to why this existed as a Zephyr build artifact. And when I looked at this file, what was cool was that this is actually RTL. And so what you can do is you can take the Zephyr binary that was built and actually embed it into the IP, into the FPGA, and now you have Zephyr in the FPGA from RTL. You don't need to have any binary be loaded via the bootloader. I thought that was pretty cool. And so the question is, so once we have all that, once we have the bootloader running, we built Hello World. The question is, does it work, right? Does the Zephyr binary, do we see Hello World on the output? And the answer is no. I didn't see any output to the console. And really, it boils down to, again, interaction with the FPGA. I was hunting around GitHub, all sorts of different forums on the internet, and I noticed that, oh, the maintainer actually responded, you know, posted this message pretty recently saying that we updated the memory map inside the or details of the FPGA, and Zephyr needed to be updated. And that's a typical problem when you're working with hardware, when you're working with FPGAs at that level. If there's updates to the underlying hardware, you have to make sure to actually update the necessary implementation in the software as well. So I was able to find a forked version of Zephyr that's still up as a PR with the fixes, and it compiled, it worked, and when I ran this tool that, again, NeoRV32 provides as a shell script to flash the binary, I was able to boot into Zephyr. So I got a Hello World from Zephyr running on a NeoRV RISC-V 32 core. So that's great, right? We got Hello World. What are some of the next steps? And this is what I think is where the power in RISC-V lies, is the custom function unit, right? And to me, this is the coolest feature because it's an extension to the ISA that really allows you to do anything in hardware, right? Any sort of operation that you can implement in the hardware, you can expose that to the software through like a single or very not like you don't have to create too many function calls. It's one or two function calls that you need to create, and you're on your way, right? And you can use that. That's extensible for any extension that you want to add, any sort of functionality that you want to add. You can use that single function call in your actual software, right? So what you need to do in the RTL is pretty simple. You need to just set this generic in the RTL to true. And when I did that, it comes with an actual function. It's a hardware multiply and add. So, you know, that can be useful for certain applications. But in this case, it was pretty cool because you have a built-in extension that you can leverage as part of just the native RISC-V ISA. The problem is, and again, this is more just FPGA problems, is that this doesn't, with the CFU extension enabled, the IP doesn't actually fit on the FPGA that I have, right? It's a common problem. Sometimes your design doesn't fit, and either you need to optimize your design or you need to go with a bigger FPGA. So going from now hardware to software, I noticed that, you know, the NeoRV32 SW software directory has kind of the relevant functions that you can use to actually implement A, detect that a CFU is enabled, and B, actually implement some of these intrinsics and call the appropriate CFU functions internally. So this is just some of the functions that are available in that example. The top is just to check if CFU functionality is available, and these are some examples of how do you actually use the different types of intrinsics within the compiler to actually implement some of the extensions that are a part of a CFU. And then this is the actual code that they have as part of their example. So one of the next steps that I want to do also in Zephyr, it wasn't obvious to me that there was a mechanism to have like that CFU functionality in Zephyr. So I want to see if I can add that support and then see like, okay, maybe we can pull in the NeoRV32 repository as like an external module like we do for other things via West, and then maybe we can add a layer within Zephyr to basically essentially abstract out the calls within the NeoRV32. So just quick summary and next steps. So I was able to get Neo RV32 working with Zephyr. Needed to kind of use a forked version of Zephyr. So maybe as a next step, I can help get some of the PRs past the finish line, help the maintainer and the authors address whatever comments that are remaining. And then my next step is actually I just ordered the Orange Crab. It's a bigger version, it's a bigger iteration of the ICE 40 FPGA that's used in the UPduino, and to see what happens. Cool.
Thank you for the talk. Do we have any questions?
Yeah, hello, sorry. Relating to this running out of space basically on the FPGA, is there any effort into kind of optimizing, so let's say I write a program and I want to run it on my FPGA, which has a RISC-V core on it. Hypothetically, now I could optimize my RISC-V core, right, based, and only have the instructions actually that I'm using. If there might be some functionality that might not be used by my application, is there any value in that or any such effort?
I mean, you kind of do that through like the use of the generics. So, I mean, optimization in my limited pretend experience as an FPGA engineer, it's that there's a balance between optimization and like time sunk. Essentially, like there's so much optimization that you could do where it's like at the end of the day, it's like, okay, now you just have to go to a bigger FPGA. Like you can try to optimize certain things out, but a lot of the times your tools are smart enough where if you're not using like a certain pieces of like the IP, it kind of just doesn't synthesize that essentially.
What is the state of this new RISC-V 32 chip? Can you buy it off the shelf without compiling FPGA sources? Because that kind of scares
me.
Yeah,
like that was kind of my original. You can. So they like Microchip, Microsemi, formerly known as Microsemi, they have SoC. They have an SoC that does have like RISC-V cores. So again, it's like that's great. Like you have like to me from a software perspective, there wasn't really any difference between okay, if I take an ARM core and a RISC-V core, like what does it do to me for me in a software perspective until kind of this implementation came about. Like I actually got to play with it, got to understand like, okay, from a software perspective, what are the actual kind of differences that I can make? Like, which I thought like, I think CFU is the biggest thing. I think vendors, like that's how they can differentiate themselves. Like if let's say, you know, they come out with a different optimized CFU, like NVIDIA comes out with the CFU to do graphics processing, right? Some other, like Google comes out with their tensor processor with, you know, CFUs to do like machine learning, right? So I think that's where a lot of the bigger companies can take advantage of.
Hi there, a fantastic talk. It's great to hear more about FPGAs in the embedded world. I had to play with a board called the Black Ice MX, which is a lattice-based FPGA by a guy called Al from the UK. And I got Zephyr up and running on it. Now they gave me loads of help, you know, because I'm clueless at this stuff, but they use the open tools that you sort of it's referred to a little bit, but they were talking about Spinal HDL and SaxonSoC as open source, you know, configurable SoC development tools where you don't have to know about VHDL and all this magic stuff that I don't understand. Have you looked at that?
I started kind of playing. So once I realized like, hey, like it's not going to fit using the Radiant tools, let me just try the open source tools and see what happens. And it still didn't fit, but at least I could say I play with it.
And when are you going to come back and tell us about running Linux on one of these platforms then on a self-RISC-V core?
Maybe at the Open Embedded Source Summit in Washington. You're going to be there.
Cool. Any more questions? Okay. If not, then thank you for a great talk.
Thank you.